You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 10, as promised, we're going to be focusing on the economy of fear as well as the architecture of fear. I'm astounded at how much money you and I spend on private security in this country. I'm also fascinated in a morbid way by my own fear in this city. I am finally growing up and trying to look for property, and it's amazing. The first thing my partner will tell you that I worry about is this place secure? I imagine whether or not you, Fraser, will be able to scale the walls of wherever it is that I live. And it's therefore not a shock to me when Aki threw out those numbers a couple of weeks ago from a security expo, and I'll get to that later in the hour, in terms of how much we spend on security. So there are two themes that I want you to join me in exploring. If you live in Joburg, if you live in any part of South Africa, if you live in a big city like Cape Town, the architecture of fear and the economy of fear that we have created because we are South Africans and fear is one of our official languages. I'm going to be joined in a little while by Joshua Lowe, who's the former director of Securex. He's going to be on the line with us to give us some stats around the economy in particular. But someone who really should be a regular on the show, other than the fact that he's a globetrotter, is Hugh Fraser. Remember the last time he was with us, we had that lekker chat about my Joburg. He is an architect, and this is a topic that he's very passionate about. Hugh, thank you so much for coming in.
It's great to be here.
By the way, do you live in a fortress?
No, I don't, actually. I live in so I lived in Troville for many years, and it was hilarious because it was for many years I was the only white by about a kilometer, and then I moved to Craigle Park, and I seriously felt under threat because I think there wasn't a single black person in my street, and I don't think there is still. But I live in a street which is really it's dead end at both ends, and it's a bit like Pleasantville. There are lawns that go down to the street, and generally it's quite relaxed, and I refuse to be cowed by this kind of thing. I mean, if your life, I had a client who lived in Dunkeld and she never opened the shutters. And I mean, I would say, like, you know what, go and live in Australia. They'll welcome you with open arms. And I mean, your life has changed a lot. I think if you have children, people worry about their families, that has an impact on it.
Yes.
But I won't be cowed by it. I mean, I do have this ridiculous situation of coming home and finding that not only was the kitchen door unlocked, it was open for like maybe 2 days. I'm like, bad boy, I should try harder.
Well, I'm delighted that you are on the show with us today and that you're not tiring of this topic. I have once in my previous life with you at Power, we had a similar kind of conversation back then. And I know that with your artistic sense and your commitment to living open spaces, that you must probably think, oh gosh, Eusebius, when are you going to get over this connection between fear and architecture? In general, and I'm going to start at the high level, and please lead me as we unravel the topic. In general, is it fair to describe a city like our wonderful Joburg as really being a landscape of fear?
To some, it's a yes-no answer. To some extent, yes, and others, no. I mean, I thought about this overnight, and I would break it down into three kind of areas. One would be terrorism, which, please God, may it not come to our shores, but one can never be overconfident about this. This is a real issue in Europe and the United States, and what you don't know is very, very quietly, those cities have been changing to counter that idea. For example, the American consulate that was in Killarney suddenly out of the blue had these very beautiful flower beds. Now, the Americans didn't take a huge interest in horticulture. Those flower beds were major, kind of, they went down 3 meters into the ground so that you couldn't drive trucks into them. So that's the one
wow.
Use. I mean, and you can rest assured now that they're kind of just here in Sandton, that building has definitely been designed to counter anything. I mean, for example, who would have thought that Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, I mean, I would never have thought that those cities would be targets of such horrendous terrorist attacks. So on that front, those cities are definitely changing. I mean, and you're going to see more devices, for example, to stop people driving trucks down the pavement, which is kind of not a good look. That's their problem. For us, I mean, I was also thinking about it, the difference between defensive architecture and the architecture of fear. One is perhaps proactive and the other one is reactive. So if you drive around Joburg and, I mean, there's that fantastic house on Second Avenue with a wall that's got more statues than Rome could wish for. So there are very high walls. There are 55 layers of barbed wire, which is kind of sculptural in itself. And then there's corporate architecture. I mean, what one doesn't realize is that corporates invest, they'd probably like to put machine gun nests if they could, but their portcullises and their bridges, their removable riot fences, because I mean, South Africa, you know, the riots for us tends to be quite a lively affair.
Yes.
So those things. So there are parts of Johannesburg that are. The whole idea of the gated community as well is a very big issue. But the reality is we're not the only city in the world. And in fact, we're not the only country. We ally a lot with other countries that have a socioeconomic profile like ours, which would be probably Mexico and Brazil. But what is kind of interesting is some stats that came out last week about the 50 most violent cities in the world. Joburg wasn't on the list. Cape Town and Durban and PE were.
Really?
Johannesburg was not. So it's a very, very floating sand pit. You know, we base our impressions very much on our own experience. So if you're living in the lovely kind of suburbs of the north, you may get an impression. And then there was the trouble 2 weeks ago in Aldo's and Lanesia. So it's a very, very varied city. There isn't a single narrative about it.
Okay, join the conversation with me and you. If you've made choices and maybe you've chosen how to have your house designed, or if you're in corporate, or maybe even if you've just been house hunting, how have you thought about your own fears? Has that impacted the kind of design choices that you've made? What's on your wish list when you do speak to an architect, or even just the choices you make about where you might rent an apartment in the city? Certainly speaking for myself, although I've now lived in Joburg since 2009, and I couldn't imagine living in any other city, including Cape Town, fear still fundamentally drives my choices when it comes to living spaces. And that's why the architecture of fear fascinates me so much. Give us a call and tell us your story on 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Samir in Norwood, good morning.
Hi, Sugis. I did a documentary many years ago about the architecture of fear. And what's happened in the last couple of years, it's actually become more and more pronounced. And I kind of do work in the inner city. I do work in the townships. I do work in the suburbs. I live in the suburb. And more I think about it, is that the racial, spatial planning is based not more, sometimes it's not even based so much on fear. And I get a feeling it's based more on racial identity and class identity. So you have a situation like in the suburbs where you have suburbs that they suddenly get to become gated communities. You know, you still want to live in your little house, but you want security guarded at every street corner. And if you're a younger person and you want to buy an apartment, it's got like 24-hour security, so you lock your door, go into your garage, and you go up to your room. So what I'm saying is that this architecture of fear, it's not only, I get a feeling it's a fear that's based on rationality, a fear of your life, your fear of losing your belongings in the sector. But I think more and more we need to have a conversation that this fear may even be driven by racism and by classism. And this
Sorry, Samir, what a delicious call.
I wouldn't disagree.
Because it nicely segues us into a theme that let's take a break here. Because as Samir was talking about issues of class, race, homogeneity, it also made me think about the other sub-theme that you have put on the paper for us to reflect on, which of course is that sometimes the walls are designed not necessarily to keep out criminality, but to make sure that outsiders don't see what we're up to.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Let's talk about how class and race enters the conversation based on what Samir had just said there, which I thought was a fascinating intervention.
Well, I mean, so walls fall very much a part of I suppose, white South African architecture. And I've got quite a lot of black friends who, after apartheid, moved into the kind of white suburbs, but found the lifestyle there so terrible that I think they either moved back to Soweto or they kept Soweto as the weekend house.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, the reality is, and Samir's right, that these things are heavily overlain with socioeconomic and racial spatial planning, which is going to take many, many years to. And I mean, I think a lot of black people don't necessarily want to live the life. In fact, I find suburban middle class life pretty damn boring. Mm. So, I mean, you know, killing a goat or slaughtering a cow.
Par for the course.
Spice things up a bit.
Absolutely.
But now we've got to have drones. I mean, maybe drones. And in fact, another thing to talk about is the impact of technology. You know, that's, you also get beam guy 50 layers of barbed wire. So technology is also going to have an impact on on security. I think the security companies.
Well, get to technology in a second. One of the things that fascinated me that you told the my producer is, for example, the origin of French burglar bars. Or what if Spanish, whatever they call, right?
Yeah,
so you've got all these like things, right? And you think that these things must be like particularly pronounced in South Africa, but some of them have got interesting global footprints.
Well, Spanish, I mean, the first to feel the jackboot of the English were the Welsh. Sorry for them. But the long, you know, whole of South America got super done in by the Portuguese and the Spanish. I mean, I think they made apartheid look like a Walt Disney story in a way. So there's the Helen Ziller guide to colonial architecture, which is probably quite pretty and,
yes,
and flourishes. But it does have a very kind of responsive style in South America, particularly places like Cuba, which I've been to, Argentina. Colonialism was ostensibly conquer and defense. So the architecture reflected that immediately. And the form that came into play there was the courtyard house. So if you walk down a street in like Trinidad in Cuba, they've got these really fantastic Spanish burglar bars, niches that hang out. And that concept is also taken into Islamic architecture, where particularly where women were in Purda, they could, you know, these little niches that overlook the street and you can go out and look down. I mean, I went to Algiers and Tunis a couple of weeks ago, and they've still got these fantastic, I mean, I don't think it was intended as a defensive wall, but the street and how the public space, semi-public space and private space, to the extent that when I was traveling in Iran, I found out that there were two knockers on the doors, and one was for men and one was for women. So by knocking on the door, you could, the inhabitants could tell by the tone, who was it a man or was it a woman? So Islamic architecture, Spanish colonial architecture have responded to the idea of defensive architecture.
That is fascinating, because often we think, not often, but let me own it. In my head, a lot of the defensive architecture or the architecture of fear that you might see in Jersey or in Cape Town is a response to a contemporary South African problem where we have pronounced inequality, and with that we have gratuitous levels of violent crime. But actually there's a far longer set of defensive roots to these architectural choices.
Allied with that is a very interesting phenomenon in South Africa, where particularly in the areas where they were pretty riven by AIDS, with child-driven households, where you would get clusters, say six houses that would be clustered around a courtyard, so that an adult could monitor the whole area. And as we were talking off air, I mean, architecture can only do so much. When you've got a healthy society, then sure, architecture will follow through. Yeah. So these are only ever going to be the symptoms.
Absolutely.
But the idea of a healthy society, I mean, even in Europe, I mean, you go to places like Denmark, which is so goddamn boring, a murder would be great.
I didn't say that.
They love crime. The Nords, you know, Nordic noir. I mean, they have like one murder a year and they're completely fascinated by murder. But you'll find some women opening the gauze curtain and looking down the street. I'm thinking, like, if you guys lived in a society like ours, you wouldn't find crime so fascinating.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to bring in Joshua here. Joshua Lowe. Joshua is the former event organizer for Securex. Joshua, thank you so much for being part of this conversation.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Joshua, we're talking now aesthetics here between me and you. You've been following the conversation. But,
yes,
of course, with aesthetics and architecture and design comes money as well. What are some of the spending patterns when it comes to South Africans and our economy of fear?
Well, I mean, to put in perspective, and funny enough, Stats SA issued a report about 2 months ago talking about spend on the private security industry and on technology in the past couple of years. I mean, in 2013, in total, South Africans spent 55 billion rand on private security measures.
Yes.
And that number, according to Stats SA, has gone up to 75 billion.
That is astounding.
Billion rand increase in the past sort of 2 to 3 years. And a lot of that's being driven by consumers. So, I mean, touching on what you were saying regarding fear and the perception of crime, you know, it's 45 billion is spent by consumers themselves, and 30 billion, and that figure has remained fairly static over the past 5 years, is spent by SAPs. So, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people now are taking extra measures to try and secure themselves.
That is scary, Joshua. How do we compare globally? Do you know?
It's very difficult to work on figures because, I mean, in some measures, you look at the number of private security guards. So yes. In South Africa, there are 494,000 people employed as private security officers. So, again, if we want to put that into perspective in terms of our own economy, there are 450,000 people employed in the mining sector.
Wow. So the private security sector is bigger than the mining sector?
In terms of employment, anyway. In terms of a number of employees. And then if you look at it in terms of the number of security guards per 100,000 people,
yes,
we have the fourth largest private security industry in the world. If you look at it from a money spend point of view, China, I mean, what's the population of China? A billion people?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. They spend, at the moment, $8.5 billion a year on private security. So that's roughly 100 billion rand. So for a population of 100 billion versus, what, 60 million people in South Africa.
My goodness.
Our spend per capita is massive.
That is insane. And that stat, Joshua, about per 100,000 citizens, where we rank fourth on our spend, can you recall at the top of your head who the three countries are that are slightly more embarrassing?
I know India is in that. Guatemala was also on that list. I'll have to double-check the other two. Panama, Honduras.
Okay.
So those are the other three. But again, you know, it depends on which measure you look at. You know, it tends to be that people either look at it in terms of the spend value, which we rank about third or fourth in,
yes,
after India, China, and the US,
yeah,
or the number of private security guards per 100,000 people. Those tend to be the two measures that we look at in terms of evaluating the size of the private security industry.
That is incredible. My jaw is virtually on the floor here, Joshua. Obviously, this is partly driven by a sense or feeling of being under siege. But in your experience, how much of this is also just, to be fair on us as South Africans, an objective response to, as you put it here in studio, an unhealthy society, but more importantly, also a broken criminal justice system? We're obviously outsourcing what the SEP should be doing to the private sector.
Yep. Well, I think that's exactly it. I mean, there's been a significant increase in the amount of money, as I've mentioned earlier on, that consumers are spending on physical security measures. So that would be obviously armed response. It would be your technology you're putting in place, your electric fences, your beams, your alarm systems. And so I think it is being driven a lot by that in terms of the fear that people have. And, you know, even in the report that StatsSA issued, they said one of the reasons that they found from the surveys they did that the amount of money had increased as much as it has is because people are generally feeling that they can't rely on SAPs as a reliable service anymore.
That, yeah. Well, absolutely. A lot of people do feel that. How much money, not you, let's put it out to the listeners. If you listen to this conversation, how much money do you spend on private security? What kind of security do you have at your house in terms of spend, in terms of technology, measures you've taken? And also, have you just willy-nilly decided that technology or private security matters? Or have you tried to incorporate it into the look and feel and design of your house? 011-883-0702. Call us in Johannesburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the economy and the architecture of fear, how fear drives our private security spend and the choices we make in terms of the design of our homes. 27 minutes before 11, we're talking about the architecture and the economy of fear. And I wonder how much you spend on security and whether you incorporate that into the design of where you are living. And perhaps Samir did, our first caller on this discussion, you want to bring in other themes that are important. Maybe we shouldn't be putting fear at the center of this conversation. Perhaps there are important issues in terms of class, race, apartheid spatial planning, all sorts of historic colonial legacies to architecture as well that inform the spaces in which we live. 011-883-0702. I'll take your calls. And in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Joshua, you've been very generous, but before we let you go, I just wanted to know, I'm very curious whether there are interesting new patterns in the expenditure of private citizens. What kind of gadgets they are now looking for at the expo? Are there new things on the market that are being taken up? Because traditionally we have ADT, it's obviously the military wing of the Democratic Alliance. And, you know, you might have an alarm inside your house and burglar bars. It usually stops there. But when I had Aki at the expo, he was just giving me a shopping list of the most amazing trinkets that were on display. What are people buying?
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, in terms of consumers, there's definitely a move towards using more technology. So you're seeing these sort of smart home apps being developed by a lot of the hardware service providers. I mean, globally, 70% of the money that's spent on private security is on the actual hardware, with the rest being made up of software and services. But I think the software and services side is definitely growing. So I think consumers and small businesses now are looking at ways that they can integrate all of this technology. You know, you don't want to just have a standalone camera and a standalone electric fence or alarm system. So a lot of these service providers now are coming up with these smart home apps that you can download, and you could be sitting on a beach in Mauritius, and you can arm or disarm certain areas, put the radio on. You can do all sorts of things. And I think it's extending beyond security to control other applications and devices within the homes. So that's some of the technology that we're seeing that came out at the expo last week and that we're seeing consumers start to adopt.
Joshua, I hope we can have you back on the show in future. This is obviously, sadly, for as long as we have an anxious society and deep inequality, a topic that will remain topical for us. But thank you so much for your contribution.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
That was Joshua Lowe, the former event organizer for Securex. Let's take a couple of calls and then we'll come back to our discussion. Let's see what some of our listeners' experiences are. Fanwell, good morning.
Good morning, Eusebius, and good morning, Hugh.
Hey.
Go ahead.
No, you know, Eusebius, I appreciate the aspects that you're looking into in terms of race, class, fear, but I think that there's one other aspect that we need to look into. When I was lecturing at Wits University, we had a program for a week that looked into what does the wall mean in to South African society. And we found that depending, obviously, on what class you form, what racial background you from, the wall either was an element of security or an element of privacy. But what I found very intriguing was that amongst most black people in the township, because one of the areas that we were looking at was the township, we found that the wall was more an element of status than an element of fear or security. Yes, that those were secondary, if you may, but what was very key to them was that they needed a wall that would express the aspirations and obviously the status of the family. So I think it's also another area that we need to look into. And when you talk about broadening the debate beyond the wall, there's also to consider the architecture of indignity. Because what you often find is when we do design in the public spaces, for example, if you design a hospital or a clinic or a bus terminus or a train station in the suburb, there's a particular aesthetic approach to how the design is, as opposed to if the same built structures were to be put in township. And that's where one finds that there is a kind of bias amongst whether it is the decision makers or whether it is the architects themselves or the urban designers. But there is a certain bias that tends to design more towards the indignity of black people than speaking to the dignity of black people. And why do I say that? Say, for example, Bara Taxi Rank, Metro Mall, or many taxi ranks that have been built. You get in them, they're very dark, they're dingy, the materials are very hard. When you ask the architect, why did you choose this particular material? No, because we're designing to avoid vandalism. And yet when you have to design house rates and airports, where even the same people are very likely to be using those spaces, we don't think about how those materials will be prone to vandalism.
Okay, we're going to leave it there, Fanua, just to get other calls as well. Your point is very well taken, and I think we need to do that full, we need to ventilate in a future program. You maybe that's a good excuse to have you back because you're so much fun. How a certain functional approach to the poor can lead to what he calls also the architecture of indignity. But I'm more fascinated by his observation, which is so true, that even if you don't necessarily feel under siege from criminal elements in the township, it might be a status symbol. Part
well,
of
I mean,
it,
I was mentioning that wall in Hyde Park with the statues. I mean, that's equally status-driven.
Yes.
So
all of these elements are present in what drives our choices.
Yeah, absolutely. Hmm. Absolutely.
Melody, hello.
Hi, Eusebius. Just a very quick thing. We were talking about the high percentage of people in the country that are on private security. Just a thought. You know, you may not. They won't. The insurance companies won't insure you unless you have a private security. So it means that everybody that's got a house will obviously have private security. Otherwise, you're not insured for your house.
Mm, that's true.
Absolutely. Absolutely, that's a very good point.
That's the same as your car. I mean, if you don't have a tracker,
whether or not you want to be insured, at least you want private security. Mm. You have to have it; otherwise, they're not going to insure you.
Mm, absolutely true. What I wanted to ask you is, when we think about all these security devices, let's now set aside what the motives are behind them. Do they have to be ugly? I mean, I know you create magic out of concrete, for example, but when it comes to technology, when it comes to burglar bars and all of this kind of stuff, does one have to make a trade-off between aesthetics and security?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think when one is designing a house, there are a whole bunch of, there's some fixed things, like north, although when I was teaching at university, the kids thought that north was negotiable, but frankly, north is not negotiable. There's aspect, there are a couple of things. And then there are a couple other variables that need to be thrown in, like materials, sustainability, and security can be chucked in as one of the things that needs to be considered. There's absolutely, I mean, Michael Sutton, a very renowned Joburg architect of the 1960s and 70s, he worked only in brick, and that he designed very beautiful houses. I mean, Islamic architecture with its geometric screens, courtyards, you know, those are very workable defense. They weren't always necessarily intended as defensive architecture, but they work very well in defensive architecture. Mm. But I mean, the one thing that I was thinking with all these people talking, I mean, did the figure that was mentioned was 78 billion rand.
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, on the one hand, you could look at it as the security industry providing a lot of jobs, but you know, it would be great if those people were employed in other sectors. I mean, where would
I think
be?
It's more the sad additional fact that it's an indicator of how weak
absolutely
the state is.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the best story I've heard, this is so South African, came out on social media overnight, was a guy whose house was under threat in Nyasa, or I don't know where it was, and he caught somebody trying to loot his house. So apart from the fact that you wouldn't be able to carry a TV down a street that's on fire, he actually got the guy to help him put out the fire, and he paid him 1,000 rand.
Wow.
So that is very proactive. Instead of, don't rob my house, help me put it out, and you'll get liquid cash. So that was a great negotiated settlement.
18 minutes before 11.
Eusebius McKaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
15 minutes before 11, and obviously that press are going on. Helen Ziller there read out a statement, and Musi Maimane as well. After 11, it's going to be full throttle. We will unpack everything. We'll bring you some sound. I'm going to tell you exactly what she said. I'm going to be interviewing Musi Maimane. I also have Karima Brown, and all the other political shenanigans will then segue into, after drilling down into what's just gone down in the DA, and also talk on Minister Malusi Gigupta, as well as what happened at the SABC yesterday. So we're going to get back to politics. But I want to take your calls, and there's a whole bunch of them here, around the architecture and the economy of fear, and that's going to take us to the top of the hour. And then in the next hour, we're going to talk politics. Michael, thank you so much for your patience.
Yes, you see this. I'm spending more on phone calls to 702 than I am on my security.
Touché.
Which is also much more than I want to spend, have been spending on security this year than ever before. But that's another story. Your question about the architecture of fear. just my own particular experience as far as my home is concerned. I decided to move into the townships from my privileged township place, and I am busy designing a house there, and I'm also wanting to attract some of my captured friends, very similar to yourself in Cape Town, back into the townships. So I'm designing something that I think that any of the more recently captured people will enjoy. Anyway, cut a long story short, where I've ended up is a three-story house, retail at the bottom, a residential on the second floor, and a penthouse on the top. But I have to confess that the penthouse, part of the design is also to include it being secure. So although I'm moving back into the moving into the townships, and all my privileged friends are really uncomfortable about me doing that.
Which township is it?
Well, I'm this one of three that I'm going to move into. It's either going to be Nyanga, Langa, or Gugulethu in Cape Town. At this stage, it's looking most likely to be Gugulethu, Tambo Village. But I'm not excluding the other two. And I'm busy going through all the plots and stuff like that at the moment.
Why are they worried, by the way, Michael? I would have thought that you probably will be less susceptible to some categories of crime now.
Well, actually, I go there often. I go there every weekend and every Wednesday, and I am going there tomorrow, and I feel really comfortable. But a lot of my friends, you know, say to me, wow, you know, even driving to Nyanga, for instance. And when I drive in there, I feel really, really relaxed and really comfortable about it. But that's obviously not what everyone else thinks. So, yeah, so I'm not apprehensive about that part. But in the house design, I've got to confess that I am including... For instance, I'm including on this ground floor two garages with fast opening doors so that access can be secure for the living
inside. Okay, makes sense. You, as much as you are an architect, you also care much about what the architectural choices that we make say about the health of our society overall. Do we know anything from the research about what kind of impact the architectural choices we make in turn, what kind of impact it has on our social relations?
Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of mixed use. I mean, the idea of demarcated areas, you live here, you work here, you dwell there, doesn't really work for me. I mean, if anybody has traveled anywhere in South America, Europe, Asia, I think what's most appealing about them is the fact that they're 24-hour spaces, you're not necessarily dependent on public transport. So the reality is that they're all tied in together. How we live, how we work, how we travel, how we eat, and the safety. I mean, the most secure places are going to be ones that are monitored 24 hours a day. And if you think about it, crime is essentially a business. So it goes where there are easy pickings. So poor areas are not necessarily unsafe areas. I mean, there are many poor areas that are very safe. There are a lot of poor areas that are not safe.
Sure.
There are rich areas that are not safe. There are rich areas that are safe. So it's a very interesting kind of curious.
And at any rate, different crimes will be voluminous across different parts of the city.
And
you might, for example, find, I don't know, contact crime might be slightly higher in a township than, say, in Sandton.
Yes.
But then your chances of a hijacking may be lower in a township. I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, one has got to be careful that you separate perception from what the stats tell us.
I mean, statistically, Cape Town is more dangerous than Joburg. That's, you know, the figures and murders and that sort of stuff. But I mean, Joburg's, as a city, is richer. So you're going to find that there's more business.
Absolutely. Talking about the business of crime. Mabule, thank you for your patience. Go ahead.
Hi, this is a great show. The per capita figure that you were giving earlier on, I think somebody must subtract the population in rural areas, because there, the spending on private security is close to nil. Actually, it's nil. You don't see the DA military wing sign anywhere in rural, in Popo or rural Popwell. They don't know anything about it. Well, I've got a house in rural areas, which is where I was born, and also in the township and in the suburb. So in the township, I owned it. I've been owning that property for the past 11 years. Probably I had close to 20 incidents of crime, some of which we've chose not to report. But in the rural areas, the house has been standing empty for the past 11 years with only one break-in. And you know, in rural areas, it's a different setup. The crime there is attended to differently than in an urban setup or maybe even in a township. Well, there it's traditional leaders, not SAPS that much. Your crimes are solved the traditional way of, if we know who the perpetrator is, will be taken to a local in Duna and so on, and that's how it will be resolved.
Mabula makes an interesting point. If we, as Thabo Mbeki once did, divide the country into two nations, I would imagine urban South Africa as one nation might be first or second and not fourth or fifth in that list that Joshua had shared with us earlier when it comes to per capita spend. Because, you know, you have, what, 50% of the population in rural areas, and they don't spend that money that we were tossing out. So the per capita spend is actually deceptive, which means that the economy of fear is even more fascinating.
Disproportionate.
I think rural people are more honest. But the food's not as good.
It's more organic. But that is a very important observation. Sipelele, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Cool. Okay, this is what I want to say. Imagine a city that is within a wall. All right. So let's take Johannesburg. The entire Johannesburg enclosed within a wall with four entry points. If you would create a space like that whereby you can manage and you can keep track of who is going in and out, I feel like you would be able to keep track of people. And if people are not able to act behind closed doors or in the shadows, they can then be deterred from criminal acts. And by doing so, people at their homes and at their business places, there'd be less of a need to have these high walls and security measures. Because if you think about it, we're a criminal society, and we need to figure out how to keep track of people and keep track of their actions so that they're not able to just do whatever without consequence.
Well, the more fundamental long-term question is, how do we reduce the factors that explain the levels of criminality, as opposed to how best can we keep tabs on each other, which is not very healthy.
Okay, well,
I'm not disagreeing with you at all. We're on the same page. I'm just saying we need you to,
well, I mean, if
to,
we had,
to spend as much energy on problem solving the crises that leads to architectures and economies of fear.
If there wasn't this need to break into people's houses, then we wouldn't need all of this.
I mean, absolutely.
We're in consultation with Donald Trump about the wall, actually, the Joburg wall. It'll be slightly cheaper than Mexico.
Way cheaper. Absolutely.
I mean, but that's what the medieval European city was. It was the walled city, which got extended to the American forts of the Midwest. So the idea of walled cities are not unusual.
Yeah. Let's take our final call. And Nonku, thank you so much for holding on.
Hi, CBS. I'll be very quick. So I just want to relay a story of my first arrival in Johannesburg, suburbia Johannesburg. So I'm from the hood, right? You know, you have your occasional dog, your fence that's not necessarily all the way up. It's just, you know, chilled vibes.
Yes.
So I moved into leafy and lushy suburbia thinking, all right, cool, everyone here is, you know, cool, no one's going to do anything. Get there, had a housebreaking. The police said to me, but ma'am, you cannot not have security, like private security of any kind. They literally laughed in my face and said, no, but ma'am, it's like, we don't understand what you expect us to do. You have to have like this outsourced to a private company, and they will then respond in an armed way or whatever. So I'm like, okay, so you guys could literally see a person walk around with a TV, with a fridge, and be like, okay, good, that's fine, carry on about your way. But I would have to have private security to come and react. So you guys don't do patrolling. What happened to police patrolling? We don't even see that anymore. The only time they patrol is to really stop people that are drunk and driving or what do you call it? Those kind of things. Stop traffic violations. They're more focused on that.
Wow.
But they don't just roam around in the neighborhoods to see all these people doing all these things. Because trust me, the Nyabe boys are very agile. They can move in small spaces very fast. But now, they can't just walk from one place to another with a fridge on their head and no one sees them. Someone's got to see that.
Some of them might try to do that.
What type of fridge?
Nonku, where did you move to, by the way? Which part of Joburg?
In Randburg.
Yeah, well, there you go, Randburg. I mean, hello.
Yes, what are you expecting?
It does still qualify as leafy and lushy, guys. Come on.
Thanks so much for your call. I'm just flabbergasted by the honesty of the Saps asking, dude, why are you surprised?
No, totally. Totally. I mean, at least we're not as bad as Zimbabwe, where you had to, if you wanted the police, you had to go and fetch them.
Yeah. We've only got 30 seconds left. What are your final thoughts to South Africans that you want to tell them in terms of how to think about design and fear?
Well, it's pretty much about proactive and reactive. I mean, I think one doesn't have to have searchlights and machine gun nests. The architecture of fear falls very much part of a healthy architectural landscape, which relates just to everything generally. The fact that the poor live so far from their place of work, they're so dependent on public transport. Mm. So these things can never be seen in isolation. Sure. A healthy society reflects a healthy architecture. And to some extent, I'm not completely sure. I mean, for example, the housing schemes of the United States, when one looks at social housing, whether they're tall or they're short or they're big or they're wide, you know, it needs to be seen in conjunction with everything else. But most of all, we need to get rid of the zuptas.
Absolutely.
That's a great start.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming
on
the
show. It's great to be here.